What's up, everybody? Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Selected Pros. I wanted to thank Marcus Pachter for becoming a patron. Super cool. Really appreciate the support. And also wanted to give a shout out to Barry Paul Clark for winning that Great American Suction David Nutt raffle. And I'm going to have some more raffles and stuff coming up, some signed books from future guests. And the podcast might be moving a little slowly now that I've got a new pup that I'm trying to raise and prevent from, what are they, eliminating all over the apartment. So bear with me, but I'll be around. Anyway, super excited about today's guest, as I am with every guest, but Gerald Brennan is just a fascinating dude. He got his European history degree from West Point, and then he went to Columbia to get a master's in journalism, and he writes these incredible historical fiction novels. I haven't read them all, but we talk about kind of where he started on that journey, and I think a lot of his life experiences really kind of inform his writing. He conducts extensive research. Books are so well thought out. They're so entertaining. His latest book, Infinite Blues, is out from Tortoise Books, which Gerald's actually the founder of. And they just released some great stuff. And Avner Landy's Meiselman the Lean Years, Avner was on the podcast in the past, that came out through Tortoise as well, so really excited about what they're doing. Huge fan of Gerald's work. I know you will be too if you check it out, and I really hope you enjoy the interview with him. So without further rambling from me, here's Gerald. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad we could finally connect.
Yeah, for sure.
Where are you? Where are you calling in from?
Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah, we're pretty northern edges of Chicago, but still in the city. So, yeah.
Are you from there originally?
My family is. We moved around a lot. I went to school in New York, and we're bouncing around the eastern half of the continent before that, and then came back here after grad school. So
cool. Yeah, I read you went to Columbia for journalism school.
Yeah.
And before that, West Point?
Yeah. So
it's cool. I mean, I'd love to hear about that. I think, you know, probably figures into your writing quite a bit.
A bit. Yeah, it's you know, there's definitely a lot of dissimilarities between the places. My, we had uniforms, just about all the time at military academy, except when we were going off post. And even our pajamas, like we tended to wear like our gym clothes as pajamas, basically. So we were in. Not only that, but cadets kind of tend to dress identically too. Like there's, like collared shirts and khakis and, pretty staid look. So like if I'm in Manhattan sometimes, or haven't been since the pandemic, but, once in a while I would spot somebody on the subway and be like, hey, what company are you in? And just totally bust them, because in the haircut too is all like, mostly similar for cadets. And then when I was in grad school, a lot of times I was wearing just a Dr. Dre t-shirt and black shorts or whatever. So
really letting loose after West Point.
Yeah. So yeah, growing my facial hair and whatnot. And, but they were hard in really different ways. And I think journalism school was probably harder for me in a way, just because at least in the military academy, like you always knew what you had to do. Like you didn't know if you had time to do it, but you always, it was pretty clear, like do this and this and this. And journalism school, it's like you knew you had time to do it, but you didn't know what it was you had to do. It's like you got this, they kind of assign you beats in the city for like the first, the first half of it. It's only a year long master's. And so my beat was Crown Heights in Brooklyn, which I didn't know much about, but sounded pretty cool. And, you know, so you're like just going down there and trying to find stories. And it's like you go to the library and it's full of kids because, you know, a lot of parents, understandably single parents, you know, tell their kid to go to the library, and the library is like overwhelmed for 2 hours, you know, after school. And then you're like, oh, like maybe this is a story, you know, I don't know. You have to just kind of pick these stories out from wherever. So, yeah.
What was the time between West Point and grad school?
It was pretty short because I actually had a medical board. So today's actually the 22-year anniversary of graduating from the military academy. I was in the class of 99, and I had a medical board. I'm narcoleptic, so they didn't diagnose me until late. I certainly wouldn't have been let in if they had realized that, or if I had realized that. And so, you know, they don't want you falling asleep, you know, leading troops. So basically, like a week before graduation, they were kind of waffling about whether or not to commission me. And like a week before graduation, they were like, you know, we're going to give you your diploma and let you go, basically. Because, you know, this was like pre-war on terror. They had more people than they needed. So, so I hadn't really made other plans, and I ended up kind of back in suburban Chicago with my parents or whatever. And I was, I went to the movies one night and I saw The Insider, you know, with Al Pacino and Russell Crowe. Have you seen that? Or
I haven't actually, no.
Oh, amazing movie. It's really, really good. Yeah. And it's all about, you know, Lowell Bergman, who is this journalist on 60 Minutes. And at the end of the movie, there was a line where somebody says, like the Mike Wallace character says to him, like, hey, does this interest you? And he goes, everything interests me. And I'm like, that's me. And then in the end credits, they're like, Lowell Bergman's a professor of journalism at Berkeley. And I was like, that's what I need to do. Like, that'll give me purpose and direction. I'll go to journalism school. And so I applied to Northwestern, and I may have not gotten my Berkeley application in on time, and then Columbia. And I was just itching to get back to New York, so I went to Columbia. So
that's cool. That's an interesting background for a writer to have.
It was fun. Yeah, it was, you know, I think both places in their own way try to teach you attention to detail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in journalism school, it was, you know, big on, you know, just asking people questions, like just, you don't know something, like call the person who's responsible for that department of the city or whatever and ask them.
Investigate, you know.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting background, and I mean, you know, this is pleased to learn your newest book, Infinite Blues, as part of a series. And before we kind of, I mean, you know, basically your background, at least to me, seems to be perfect for this kind of writing. It's very, you know, it's very densely researched, I feel like. Before we get into Infinite Blues and everything, like what? When did you make that switch from journalism to fiction, and kind of like where did Altered Space begin?
Well, like a lot of people who go to journalism school, I did not end up working in journalism. And that's no knock on the program. I mean, they give you all the tools, but, you know, there's only so many jobs.
When was that, by the way? When were you in journalism school?
2001 I graduated. So like I graduated in May of 2001, like right before 9/11 and all that stuff. And
it's probably, you know, it was, it like, did you get a sense that Columbia, the journalism school, kind of felt the internet coming as like this disruptor of?
They did. They did really try to kind of give you, and I think there were four, there were different tracks. So there was like radio, TV, internet, and newspapers. And me being an idiot, you know, chose newspapers, you know. So, you know, I got myself in the least you know, the least saleable or special.
Well, how could you know that people would be getting their news from tweets 10 years in the future, you know?
You know, well, I mean, even then I was already reading a lot of stuff online because, like, as a cadet, they make you read, you know, they used to make you read the New York Times, and as a plebe, you had to be able to talk about any story on the front page of the New York Times and any story on the front page of the sports page. Like, an upperclassman stopped you and said, you know, what happened, you know, back then we were, you know, people forget we were kind of at war with Iraq, like, for the whole, like, interim from 91 to 2003. So, yeah. Like, sir, today in the New York Times, it was reported that in Iraq, the United States launched anti-radiation missiles against a surface-to-air missile site, you know, and if you, like, messed up or you stuttered, you had to, like, sir, may I make correction, and they, you know, cause if you said, like, an abbreviation or something, like, they would get, you know, but you had to just kind of talk, you know, talk from some informed basis of, you know, whatever was in the Times. And then by the end of that, by the end of our 4 years there, I think the commandant realized, like, hey, I don't need to get newspapers delivered. Like, we can, you know, we can go to
NBC
News or whatever. And, you know, so by then the plebes were reading the Washington Post online or whatever. So
interesting. Interesting. And was that a ritual specific to your class, or is that an old time tradition?
No, that was an old.
Oh, that's cool. I never would have known that. That's interesting.
Oh yeah. Yeah. They were really big on that. So amount of stuff you had to just memorize and be able to, like, if somebody stopped you and asked you what was for dinner, you had to say, like, sir, for dinner we're having mashed potatoes, meatloaf. I already messed it up because it's like main course, side course, dessert, and drink. So, like, that dinner would have been, sir, for dinner we're having meatloaf, mashed potatoes, cherry cobbler, whatever it was. And, you know, but even if I'd, like, hesitated that long, they would, you know, depending on what kind of mood they were in. I mean,
yeah,
during summer training, they were all, like, eager to haze you. And then once the academic year started, like,
it's time to
they
get
would
serious.
Still do it, but they were a little, you know, everybody was bogged down in school too. So it was,
yeah. That's so interesting to me. So you,
you asked about what the transition was.
Yeah,
so I just kind of took a normal person job in downtown Chicago.
What was that? What were you doing?
I was working at a telecom company.
Okay.
And the funny thing was, it was in the Sears Tower. So, like, I think I'd gotten a job in June or something. So maybe, like, a month after J school graduated. So then I'm just working this normal job in the Sears Tower. And then, like, 9/11 happens, and and we were only on the sixth floor. So it wasn't like I was, like, looking out the windows for airplanes or anything like that. But it definitely, like, gave me that, like, you don't know how much time you have on this earth. Like, you do not know. Cause, like, the people who are in there, they had no reason to believe that was their last day, you know, when they went to work. And so it was like, what are you going to have to show for this time? You know, like, are you gonna, you know? And so I think I started, I picked up this manuscript I'd been, like, working on, like, very sporadically in the year between undergrad and grad school. Cause I always kind of knew I was a writer, you know?
You were always toying with fiction.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't even something I wanted to be. It was just something I knew I was, kind of, you know. And in some ways, I went to grad school to, like, make myself write. So I was like, well, if I, you know, which I think a lot of people do, like, well, if I'm in school, then I'm going to have to do it.
I'm currently doing that right now, just spending exorbitant amounts of money to make myself responsible. Yeah.
So it works in a way. I mean, I'm, like, after that, I, like, picked up that manuscript and started working on that. And I was very, like, you know, I was somewhat, I definitely didn't have the work ethic I have now with it, but, you know, I was still, writing since then. And I finished that project, and I think I ended up like,
was that part of this whole series, the Altered Space series?
No, that was like this kind of garbagey noir. I never put it out. I don't know if I'm ever going to revisit it, you know, but yeah. I think you need to do it.
Get it out of your system.
Yeah. You know, and then I never put that one out. And then the next one was kind of self-life inspired. And I kind of self-published that one under a pen name. And then I was like, my next project was like, all right, this is like this World War II like epic called Resistance about, so the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. I don't know if you're familiar with
Yeah,
that.
I am.
Yeah. How are you from, where did you hear about it? Or
I've been into World War II since I was a young kid, probably in the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich or something. I don't know. I've read about it many times.
Okay. Yeah. It was weird. Cause like when I was in high school, I read Fatherland by Robert Harris, and like he has Heydrich as a big character in that. And then there's this footnote in the end of the book. Oh, this guy was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
Like this guy that in this alternate history book is like taking over Nazi Germany after Hitler. So I was like, why do I not know about this? How come it's, you know, and I think it is kind of, you know, like they say, like you write the book to kind of find out what it's about or
yeah.
Whatnot. And I think my take on that is it's, you know, it's certainly not a feel good story. And I think it kind of confounds a lot of our sense of propriety, because like you want like killing a really bad guy to be a really good thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. But here, like, you know, arguably the worst person in Nazi Germany after Hitler was assassinated. And, you know, the people, they're certainly not household names, you know, the people who did it. I mean, there's certainly people who are into it who geek out about it like me, but, the people who did it didn't get, you know, anything other than a, you know, a violent death of their own a few weeks later, basically. So
the Heydrich one was internal, right?
He was, so the Czechs, the Czech government was in exile in London, and they, Czechoslovakia is fascinating. I kind of geeked out on their history to this, which is interesting, because I think when you get this into something, people assume like, oh, you must be Czech or something.
Yeah, you must have like, some ancestral connections.
Yeah, no. So during World War I, this guy, Tomáš Masaryk, basically left Prague, you know, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, left Prague in 1914 as this, like, you know, unemployed professor and, like, member of this rubber stamp parliament. And through his own diplomacy during World War I, like, raised an army of Czechs to fight alongside the Allies out of, you know, POWs who were in Russia, like, you know, got this force, like, trained and equipped and stuff like that. Went to the U.S., like, raised all this money for the Czechs and, like, got all this support for Czech independence and whatnot. And, like, they actually declared their independence here in Philadelphia. And so he went back over to Europe as the president of this country that he had created through his own diplomacy. So it's this huge, like, incredible accomplishment. And he's really an amazing guy. Like, it's really kind of sad more people don't know about him. He's the closest thing to an American founding father you'd find outside of the U.S., but also without, like, I mean, certainly the founding fathers were pretty problematic with, you know, the legacy of slavery and whatnot. And this
but
guy
that
was
kind like, of that kind of like mythical yeah. status space.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he was like super he was so advanced on like women's issues and whatnot that like he and his wife basically took each other's names. So like Gary U. Masaryk.
Okay.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
His last name or whatever. And like
incredible for 1942 or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no. Yeah. Yeah. So, so he came back in 1918, had created this country, done this great feat of diplomacy. And then the Czechs during the Second World War, their leadership was in exile again. And so like, this is the great tragedy of history is we're like addicted to our own like successes and failures, you know? And so they thought like, well, we have to do this again. We have to, you know, do some big contribution to the Allied war effort. And, you know, otherwise we're not going to get a seat at the peace table like we did mm-hmm. in 1918. So they decided to pull off this assassination and they pulled it off. It was very,
yeah. Didn't they like parachute in or like jump him in the woods or something? I forget, but
yeah, they parachuted in. They were off course from where they were supposed to be. Cause I mean, even just parachuting, you know, I mean, they radio navigation was, you know, the only technique, and it was very, very inaccurate. You know, so they dropped him like way off course, and they, one of the guys injured his leg when they were landing, and it was a very, it was very lucky that they didn't get picked up, but there were a lot of, you know, Czechs who helped him out, and, they staked out Heydrich's route, like to and from work, and, found this spot where he made a hairpin turn and, jumped out to assassinate him. And the one guy's gun jammed like right in front of
my Lord.
Car. Yeah. And and so he's like.
All the bad luck. They get a shitty landing.
Yeah.
They don't know where they are. I know Heydrich suffered for a while, right?
So what happened was this was 79 years ago. Thursday would have been the 27th. Yeah. So Heydrich was traveling around with just a driver in a convertible. Mm-hmm. Cause like he didn't want the Czechs. He was afraid of them. So like, rather than telling his driver, like, get the hell out of here. He says like, stop, I'm going to mm-hmm. get this guy, and he like stands and draws his pistol. And the other member of the team, Jan Kubisch, threw a grenade, which exploded like outside of the car and injured Heydrich. And they get in this gun battle and the guys run off like thinking they failed. And meanwhile, Heydrich had been wounded. He had like horsehair and like car material and stuff like driven up into his spleen, and there was a hospital like right around the corner, and they drove him to the hospital, but he ended up dying like a week later. But the Germans went nuts because they didn't, they didn't know what had happened. They thought they had pacified the continent, and their mindset, and like this is like, it kind of creeps you out a little bit. Their mindset was like, we're going to make Europe a German continent, and, people might have a problem with it now, but like 50 or 80 years from now, it'll just be kind of settled history. Mm-hmm. And their attitude was like, look at what the Americans did to their continent,
Yeah.
Nobody cares now. It was a mess at the time, but now it's kind of settled history. And so they thought they had pacified Europe and we're turning it into a German continent. So here's this attack in the center of Europe on this guy that one of his contemporaries called him the hidden pivot of Nazi Germany, because he was in charge of like all the police state functions basically. And so they were going nuts, and they they had the biggest manhunts in Europe, and they still weren't turning anything up. And then finally this other parachutists from another mission said like, hey, like, I don't know where they are right now, but the guys who did this are Kubisch and Joseph Gobchik. And, if you knock on such and such a door in Prague, they might know where they are. And they, the Germans knocked on the door of one of the safe houses and arrested this family. And I think the mom, I think she committed suicide. Like she like snuck into the bathroom and mm-hmm. took cyanide or whatever. But they took the son in, and I think the Gestapo showed him his mother's like severed head and like got him really drunk and said like, you know, you want this to happen, you know, to your dad, to, you know, whatever they said, you know. And the kid like knew the name of the church where they were holed up in the crypt of this church. And so these guys were surrounded by like 500 troops of the Waffen-SS, and they just fought to the death and, you know, killed themselves with their last bullets, basically. So, Jesus.
And so where, and you wrote a historical fiction book about this? From which perspective?
From which perspective? The first third was kind of based on I novelized the memoirs of this Czech spy master, like František Moravec, who had kind of orchestrated this, you know, and he was kind of one of those generation of Czechs who had, you know, lived through the triumph of winning their independence after the First World War and then having to do it again in the second. And then it was kind of in found document form, my book. And then the middle third form. Yeah. And I mean, I was a history major at the military academy. Like I wasn't an English major, because like the English department there was like everything you would imagine a caricature of a military English department to be. It was like, you know, methodical recitation of poems and
it's not about the rigid essence of
there was no like creative writing.
It's like just memorize this
but the history, I'd been a history major, and so I just really enjoyed that, like
that's
primary source kind of thing. So
primary sources for sure. I mean, your work feels very well researched. And to remind you, I had been learning a little bit recently about the Mossad hit against Herbert Zuckers.
I'm not familiar with that one.
I'm going to have to send it to you, because I just finished a podcast called The Good Assassins Hunting the Usher, and I think you'd absolutely love it. But it's it's right up. He was Herbert Zuckers was a Latvian. He was an aviator who became a vehement Nazi and turned on his kind of own community. And later Mossad tried to hunt him down. Is the story of that.
So,
it's pretty cool.
Check
that out. But dude, I really like that. I really like the approach of kind of like finding these details about the Heydrich assassination and trying to basically bring something more unknown into the forefront of the story.
So we've been like babbling about the book you haven't read yet.
No, it's okay, but it sounds so interesting to me. I'd love to read it too. All of this then precedes this sort of like Cold War epic series that's an alternate history, right? I mean, Infinite Blues, your latest book, is a choose your own adventure, which I find to be very interesting.
Yeah.
Were they all like that, or
no I you know, the first one there are, so there it's
or I actually love... how about this, before we get into the details of the book, can you kind of talk about like the world of Altered Space?
So after this, you know, after I got Resistance out, like there's this point where you kind of feel like you've sold as many as you're gonna sell, and it was a decent amount. I mean, it was like, I mean, I've probably sold like 1600 of them all told, but but the, you know, there's this point where sales are kind of tapering off and you're like, you know, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. And I ended up in the hospital in 2012. I had a staph infection, and I was like really feeling bad and like super sorry for myself. And I don't know why I thought of like Apollo 13, the movie Apollo 13. I was like, you know what? Those guys didn't feel sorry for themselves. They just did what they had to do, you know.
That military perseverance in you.
And the and somebody had mentioned, like, oh, if you're a writer, you should write, like, series. Like, don't write just one book, you know, like, write a series, you know. So I was like, you know, that had been percolating in my brain, like, write a series, write a series. And then I think it was in the hospital that I started thinking of, like, just these different alternate history space things. Like, what if Apollo 13 had landed on the moon and then had problems? Like, what, you know, I mean, because it was, the scenario they had was fairly dire, but it was also, you know, more survivable than it would have been if, you know, they had been on the moon, you know, and they didn't have the whole lunar module consumables to live off of, you know. So, like, what if they had landed on the moon? And then I was like, well, what if the Soviets landed on the moon? You know, what if, you know, like, you stumble onto these Wikipedia articles about, you know, manned flybys of Venus. And, like, what if we had launched a manned flyby of Venus, like, in the 70s, you know, and just all these things like that. And, like, you know, I just remember, like, jotting down a bunch of these ideas. And, you know, and I had been an aviation geek kind of as a kid. Like, I probably would have tried to fly if I didn't have, you know, bad eyes. But, you know, that aviation geekdom kind of came back at some point in the 2000s. I read Andrew Chaikin, A Man on the Moon, which is, like, amazing. Like, one of my top five, like, nonfiction books of all time. It's, like, the definitive Apollo story. And, yeah, like, I kind of, like, geeked out on this notion of, like, you know, just writing a book that felt like a trip to the moon, you know? And then, you know, they're all kind of circular. Like, I really like, I mean, obviously, you know, orbits and, you know, our, a lot of our lives are defined by this circularity that we spend a little bit of time thinking about, but not too much, you know, whether it's, I mean, it, you know, but it kind of becomes an effective, just part of life that you take for granted. But so all of them are somewhat circular, but I in the five of them, because I just finished the fifth one Thursday morning, actually.
Congratulations. Is this the one Alone on the Moon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know if the ones in the front of the book here were chronological or not, but.
Yeah. So this is the fifth and final one. And the first one was Zero Phase. It was an Apollo 13 alternate history. The second one was Public Loneliness, which was about the Soviets flying somebody around the moon. And it kind of gets into...
Is that about Yuri?
Yeah. So gets into, you know, alcoholism and image control and things of that sort that were kind of near and dear to my heart. And then Island of Clouds was the third one. And I finished that one on Election Day of 2016, which was really fortuitous because, I was kind of, I knew there was a possibility that Trump would win, but I knew it was going to be just a shit show, you know? And I just remember being up that night and, like, trying to go to bed and be like, just fuck, they really fucking did it.
And trying to accept, like,
like
the unreality of the situation. I really couldn't even believe it. And
I was
like, well, the world is now definitively changed. It was one way and now it's a new way. So,
But then Infinite Blues ended up having a real, you know, in some ways that was my my statement on conservatism. But I did try to be a little politically equal opportunity roasting, because I think there's certainly grounds for criticism everywhere in the American political spectrum. So
So can you talk a little bit about you know, some of the inspiration, like, what can you give the pitch about Infinite Blues and sort of, you know, what it's about? And
yeah, yeah.
So, writing it.
Yeah, so basically the United States in the 60s wanted to launch essentially a manned spy satellite space station type thing, because we had great camera technology, but we didn't have the image technology. Like we couldn't get images digitally down to Earth. Like we actually had to put film in like these buckets and like eject them from satellites and like parachute them down to Earth. And one of the problems too is like these automated satellites, they didn't know whether there was like cloud cover or anything. So they would potentially burn up whole rolls of film, like shooting
nothing.
Yeah. And the thing was, it's really, you know, one of the things I love about history is you do really empathize with everybody when you understand what they were afraid of. And the United States in the 60s was just petrified by these fears of like a nuclear Pearl Harbor. Like, you know, because the Soviet Union was a closed society. We didn't know what they were doing. And, you know, they had all these scary parades and stuff and, mm-hmm. you know, Khrushchev giving scary speeches and whatnot. And it's easy to see in retrospect that was like bluff and bluster from a weak country that had been, you know, just devastated and traumatized and faced a sneak attack of their own in World War II that they were trying to avoid that calamity. But to us in the 60s, it looked like, you know, this big scary monster that we needed to know everything right. about. So we had these spy satellites, and they actually had the technology to get 4-inch photographic resolution from these satellites, but they thought they were going to need people up there to like develop the film and send it back and stuff. And, you know, so they wanted to, you know, count up all the Soviet missile sites and this and that. And so I kind of imagined that in a situation where the space race was hyper-militarized, where like, you know, we're not distracted by this kind of noble, peaceful goal of going to the moon, but mm-hmm. we're just, you know, like in my book, you know, the U.S. never, you know, World War II dragged on a little longer, and then we ended up with like a President MacArthur.
Yeah, McCarthy's president. Yeah. That's a nice touch. I mean, he's fueling all the fear domestically. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, MacArthur, yeah, not McCarthy.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, because it's easy to, you know, and it's funny because like January 6th happened after all this, but even before that, it was easy for me, like as much history as I read, to imagine like, you know, are our institutions that strong? Like what would happen if we, you know, if we had somebody who decided like, oh, I'm going to, you know, manipulate the end of, you know, the two-term amendment, you know, to the Constitution mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of install myself as, you know, kind of a quasi, you know, still a quote president, but, you know, one with no effective challengers, you know, mm-hmm. what would that be like for the country? And like, and how many people would go along with that? Because, you know, the guy talks tough, but things are still kind of peaceful and, you know, you got your family life is okay. And like, you know, you've been through this big war and now you've got somebody who seems to be quote, keeping you safe. So, you know, I mean, that would be, and I mean, we've seen subsequent to me finishing that, I think how seductive that is to some Americans, just mm-hmm. that notion of the strong man kind of keeping them safe, you know, which of course is an illusion, but, you know, it's a seductive illusion. Mm-hmm. So and I was fairly conservative growing up too. I mean, I'm a little more open-minded now, but like I was always a little, I'm still a little intrigued by that. And reading Rick Perlstein's book too, and like reading about Goldwater, like you see, you know, for as much as some respectable conservatives like try to distance themselves from Trump, like the seeds of Trumpism were back there with Goldwater, like this kind of thumbing your nose at the media, which, to be fair, the media was, you know, a little in bed with LBJ until 68, like in our real timeline, you know, but the media, I think, you know, is a well-meaning organization, but it can get seduced, you know, it can get, and people can get lulled into this kind of bullshit court reporting stenography type of thing where it's just like, oh, like you're covering a royal wedding, but like you're not asking like whether the monarchy is an institution that you want, you know, like it's and that just as easily happen in America. So I kind of tried to get at that in the book. So yeah.
And when was this released?
I released it in April, but I finished it. So basically I finished it last March, like right as we were going into COVID. Quarantine.
Yeah.
Like I literally finished it finished the first draft on March 18th, which was like, I think Wednesday of the first week that I was on lockdown. So it did kind of feel, I mean, not to spoil too much, but it ends up being a kind of apocalyptic book. And, and it did kind of feel like the world was ending.
Yeah, of course. The reason I asked when it was released is because you must have felt, I mean, I'm sure some of the inspiration in the book came from like the current political climate in the United States, but
yeah.
Felt pretty prophetic,
In
terms of like dealing with authoritarianism and stuff, and in like the way that kind of like nationalism and everything's been sprouting up all over the world, and
there's
like an issue that's at the core of this book, and
definitely, because I mean that's it's weird, like there's a little like UFO theme too, like which. Mm-hmm. Kind of surprised me. I didn't expect that to be in there. Not that there's UFOs in the book or whatever, but obviously that's one of the great unanswered questions of the human condition, you know, is like, are we alone or are we not? You know, and then the thing you realize is like, well, shit, we have a hard enough time getting along with each other. Like, you know, like people that are our same height and weight and like have a different skin tone, like we have a hard time getting along with. So like, fuck, we can't handle aliens. Like we can't even handle each other barely, you know. It's
and that's bubbling up now too, right? These Pentagon reports about
UFOs that is fascinating.
It is fascinating.
One of those 60 Minutes clips, somebody posted it on Twitter,
and I was pretty skeptical
of this stuff before that. But anytime you have like a couple of people talking and they're, you know, they're credible people with like big careers and like, you know, a lot to lose by, you know, I mean, people in the service like that, that the one thing you don't want in the service is for people to think you're like, you know, not right. In the head. I mean, you know, other than like the, you know, like the bloodthirsty rah-rah kind of useful crazy from a service perspective. Like, you know, you don't hear people about UFOs or...
No, not until recently.
Yeah. So to have that many, you know, as somebody who was in the military, like to have that many like ex-military people like talking in front of her, like, yeah, in front of each other, like, yeah, this is what we saw, you know. Certainly it was interesting. And yeah, there is a chance that there was some other like, you know, Navy super secret project that they didn't know about. But, you know, the flip side of that is having been in the military, I know it's you know, it's, I mean, they're just people, like, and it's hard to keep secrets, like, and it's hard to really, you know, I mean, you know, does the military keep some secrets? Yes. But like, you know, the notion that we would have these capabilities that they're talking about on video and it not leaking out yet is somewhat tough to fathom. I mean, right.
Like anti-propulsion or whatever. Like they don't even have, in like switching 180 degrees in less than a millisecond.
Stuff
is kind of unfathomable.
Oh yeah. No, yeah. It's certainly, you know, there's a lot of questions and not a lot of answers right now. And it's interesting.
It is interesting. I definitely want to talk more about the craft of writing historical fiction, but personally, I'm kind of curious, like, as someone who's such a historian like yourself, what do you, and you've written a book that is somewhat apocalyptic, or at least can be. What, and by the way, I just want to throw this in here really quick. There's a certain point where it says, where you ask the reader, did you really just launch a fucking nuclear bomb at a country? Like, go back to page 400 or whatever. So it's got some humor in it, you know, but.
It's a little, yeah. It was kind of, you know, I mean, it's.
It tests your humanity a bit.
It does. Yeah, no, it does. And the military is, you know, people outside of the military don't necessarily see it, but the military is full of some really funny people. But part of the tragedy in that is they're funny because it's a defense mechanism against these horrible things that they're potentially being asked to do. Like these, you know, like when you watch Dr. Strangelove and the, you know, they have like Dear John written on the nuclear bomb. I mean, that's the type of thing people do in the service.
Yeah, because I can imagine.
If you don't laugh about it, you go fucking insane, you know, and you still may go crazy anyway. But yeah, like it's some of the funniest people I've ever met were in the military, and part of me misses it, but part of me is like just truly grateful that I didn't end up serving through all this, because I, you know, I might have gone nuts, you know.
Of course. Like, yeah. Know? Yeah.
So, and some people are able to compartmentalize and handle it. And, you know, I had a professor who carried the nuclear codes for Reagan for 2 years, you know, and he was you know, one of the most, you know, stable, normal sounding, like rational, you know, I mean, he, you know, I mean, if you have to have a job like that, he was the person you would want to give it to. But he had a dark sense of humor about it, like, because I mean, that's a crazy thing to have to think about,
of course, you know, yeah,
a couple of years, you know.
I've recently been learning too, the, like, everyone thinks about the Bay of Pigs and the Kennedy in Kennedy and like the 60s as being like the 60s 70s as being kind of like our most our closest brushes with death in terms of nukes, but like the Reagan administration was no picnic. Like we were on red alert
for some time
with him too.
There was you know, with, I remember that professor, like he gave a slideshow at the end of class, and he was showing some slide, like, here's the scene in, you know, we were at the Augusta National Golf Course with Reagan in 1983, and there was a security scare. And he's like, and we didn't know, like, did, you know, is this just some crazy lone guy, or is this, you know, a team of Soviet commandos trying to kill the presidents, like, and launch World War III? And there was definitely some very cold years of the Cold War from like 83 to 85. So, yeah, it was.
I really like the notion, something you brought up earlier, too, about organizations that kind of like determine the fate of nations or whatever, but they are really just run by people. Is that something that you think about a lot? Just like human error. Human error, just, you know, like, I think we almost like mythologize what government agencies are, and what they can do, but it's like some of the people in there are just like your average dude. He might be tired one day, and he might be angry at his wife, and some decision is made. Do you think about that a lot, like cause and effect, or at least I get the sense that you do?
A certain amount, yeah, a certain amount, and it is, It was interesting. Like, I watched a lot of documentaries about like nuclear missile silo crews and stuff while I was writing this. And like, you know, you do get the sense that they try to keep pretty stable people there. You know, they try to get people who have, you know, stable family lives and have a lot to lose. And like, but that was like one of the fascinating things for me is like the guy with, you know, the key to the nuclear missile and like a picture of his family, like on the console, you know, like that's another kind of crazy basically than, you know, the foaming at the mouth kind of crazy, like this notion that like, you know, I have to hold the world hostage with a nuclear weapon so that we don't have a big war, you know, like, so.
Part of your research into this book and probably other books, which I was always excited to talk to you about, is Richard Rhodes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think you said in Infinite Blues that you had read Dark Sun, which I haven't read, but I'm kind of wading through the history of the atomic bomb. If you've read that one, but for people who don't know, he's just an unbelievable Pulitzer Prize winning
I was a little bummed. I tried to get a blurb from him and he was too busy, but he like responded like the same day, which is always like a weird, like, you know, like grateful, sad kind of combo where like, oh my God, Richard Rhodes, like, yeah. Send me an email and he's like a nice guy. And like,
he could send you an email, be like, hey man, just send me a blurb. Another email. But
yeah,
that, no, he's really kind of fascinating. And like so densely researched and intensely researched. And even the smartest people in the world, it's funny that they are just people. And you know, the Oppenheimers of the world or the Niels Bohrs of the world or whoever, it's just, you know, they've got their
own. And they get like, you know, I feel like everybody's brain gets caught in certain grooves after a point. You know, it becomes harder to be original. It becomes harder to like come up with new thinking to confront what's in front of you. It becomes easy to fall back on the, you know, oh, this is like this, this is like this, and just to kind of fall back on your stock answers and stock speeches for everything. And I think, you know, that certainly happens to those types of people too. I mean, that was how we got Vietnam, you know, like they had this worldview of, well, we have to deter aggression and make a strong stand. You know, they had this worldview that was forged in, you know, by looking at what happened in World War II. And they were like, well, we have to, you know, and not stop in to think like, okay, Ho Chi Minh is not another Hitler. Like he's not, you know, he's, you know, it's just, it's a different situation. It's different people. It's different. And it's not to say that they were like a perfect paradise or like a great noble cause necessarily themselves, but it, you know, it's every situation is its own thing, you know, like, and
you've got to take the facts as they are and deal with them.
Yeah.
I mean, it brings us back to what you were saying about the Czechs in World War One, World War Two.
Yeah, exactly.
Behind that assassination. And it's interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting theme. I mean, are you at all, you know, in terms of historical fiction, are you at all, like, were you inspired by like the Pynchons of the world, or did you read much of him, or like?
Oh yeah. I read a lot of. I mean, I read Gravity's Rainbow 3 times. I did get it the second time. I think it was. Yeah. A little,
I mean, I think he kind of.
Yeah.
I think he kind of addresses that theme in at least in Gravity's Rainbow of essentially like. Facts are what they are, and like, you know, there's no real way to. Makes sense.
There's so much entropy creeping into the system. I feel like that was my big takeaway from that.
Like, yeah, like chaos and entropy.
Yeah, like you can try and organize what you want, but just the laws of thermodynamics, like there's so much chaos building up outside of this little thing that you're trying to manage. That, like, you're never going to be on top of it.
You're never going to manage it, and you're never going to like fully understand it. You're going to basically come up with the best representation you can, and it's still shit.
It's
not quite there.
Like, you know, nobody, and that's kind of at least been our salvation in some respects, like even the, you know, the quote evil geniuses of the world or whatever, like they can't control all the variables, you know, like they just can't, you know, they just can't account for everything, you know? So.
So I'm very interested then, like what your, you know, in the acknowledgments of this book, I mean, it's just, you really go ham on telling us like all the resources you went into and stuff. And I mean, it's super impressive. And like,
that's an old West Point legacy. I mean, you had to kind of document your work and
like, show your work. Yeah. But it's like, what, I mean, this book is filled with factual information that I think the average American wouldn't really be aware of. And so I'm kind of, other than your military background and such, I'm kind of interested just like, if I were to set out to write a work of historical fiction,
you
start with the moment of like Hydra's assassination or this lunar or this orbit, you know, where this spy orbit or something, but like kind of, you know, what is the ratio between your creative mind and like the drawing from primary sources?
It's always a back and forth. And there's a great quote from Martin C, who's a great author and a friend of mine. And, you know, like, when you're stuck, do research. And when you're not stuck, stop doing research. So like with this one, for instance, like I had, there was a retired space shuttle flight director who had done some technical consulting with me on the last book. And so for this one, I was like, you know, what would their orbit be like? You know, because some of these people had written papers about the, you know, because, you know, normally spacecraft are at a lower orbital inclination, like as close to the equator as possible. And you know, launching from Cape Canaveral, you're at like 28 degrees is like the lowest you can get. And you know, for the space station, we have to do it in an orbit that the Soviets can reach, so, or the Russians can reach. So it's like 55 degrees, but this would have been like a 90 degree orbit, like going over the poles, which, so you're like, all right, what ground stations would they have talked to? Like, oh, and then you realize like, oh, we have a base in Thule, Greenland, you know, which, you know, you realize if you're looping around the Earth that way, a base near the North Pole is going to be in line of sight a lot more than a base like, you know, down on the equator. So then you realize like, okay, like they're talking to Greenland a lot, you know, they're talking to Alaska a lot, you know, they're not talking to, you know, Cape Canaveral or whatever, like nearly as much, because they would be out of sight, you know? And so it's just like little things like that. And you just,
and that brings in new scenes, you know, or like new.
Exactly. Yeah. So then you read on the internet, like, well, what's life like for an airman space, you know, stationed in Thule, and like,
right.
You know, what do they joke about? You know, what do they do in their free time? You know, just that kind of stuff. So it's just kind of, you know, you read a little, write a little, read a little, write a little, and you know, just try to keep the momentum going, basically. So
do you ever, does that ever drive you a little nuts to try to have to figure out all these details? Like, how do you
figure
out?
Yeah.
I was going to say,
certainly. Cause like this current one, like it's, you know, so the one I just finished, it's like a Soviet lunar landing. And I was trying to think of like, all right, what would cause them problems from lifting off? And then I was like trying to run through battery problems, and, you know, and then you're researching all this stuff, and then you're like, sometimes you just can't sell yourself on it, you know?
Yeah.
And then you're like, all right, I've got to throw that out and I've got to try something else, you know? But, you know, as long as you're moving forward, I think, and as long as you give yourself like one day off, and like only one day off every week, I think. Like,
but it sounds like you're writing all the time,
6 days a week.
That's great.
I work on my stuff when I'm in it. Most mornings I start working on my stuff and then work on Tortoise stuff. But then Saturday, like, I'll work on tortoise stuff first. So I'm making sure I'm moving all the things forward with that. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm not in a big project, then I'm just, you know, getting up and, you know, editing every day or whatever.
So, yeah. Well, I definitely want to talk about tortoise too. And,
Oh, yeah.
You know, first thing, I just want to say that, like, it's, I'm very excited that I found your work and, like, you, I mean, I'm specifically interested in this stuff, like, Cold War obsessed and everything, but also yeah. It's just, I don't know, it's refreshing to read something so well researched. And, like, I felt like I learned a lot, and I could tell you kind of put everything into it, like, from your military background to the research. Like, there's no fluff.
Yeah. No, I tried to really, I tried to make it a satisfying read. I like forgetting that I'm reading a book or forgetting that I'm watching a movie or whatever. So I try to make it that immersive of an experience.
Yeah. I think that's the goal. And, you don't have to tell us if you don't want to, but does the Altered Space series, how does it end in a less apocalyptic way than I would expect?
It ends on a sort of optimistic, I mean, they're all disconnected basically,
right.
Stories. So, like, it ends on a somewhat more optimistic one, but that's, you know, that's something I've been grappling with a lot, is like how much of a downer does, like, decent, respectable fiction have to be, you know, like you don't want to tell just, like, bland crap, but you also don't want, like, just, I mean, I don't think I could write another book as depressing as this one.
cynicism for the sake of itself is kind of what's the point?
I mean, wears out after a while.
So. Yeah, but as a historian, like yourself, like, what do you actually personally believe? Like, is the future? Are you optimistic about the way things are going?
I really waffle between. On one hand, I think that, you know, these populists, like these right-wing populists, are being shown to be incompetent and unable to handle real crises, you know, by, mm-hmm. you know, this crisis that's dealt with it. Like somebody said on Twitter, you know, just one of those tweets that you just remember, like somebody said, like dictatorships are very good at dealing with fake crises and very bad at dealing with real crises, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I think you saw that in the Trump administration and their, you know, I mean, wannabe dictatorship granted, but certainly a lot of the same tools and methodologies. So there's certainly a hope that, these people are being, defeated by something that's, you know, showing the inadequacies of their way of doing things. But there's certainly that fear that that you're condemned to repeat a big disaster once a certain number of generations has gone past. And it's right. not like, I mean, that's, I mean, John Hersey's Hiroshima, I think, is the most important piece of writing of the 20th century. And in some ways, maybe as important as anything since the Bible, to me, at least. I like the Bible, but but just the fact that we could read that and see what had happened in a real nuclear attack and scare the shit out of us mm-hmm. and not do that. You know, because I think that was in some ways what kept us from a bigger nuclear war in the 60s was just this lingering thought in the back of people's minds that this would be literal hell on earth,
right.
you know? And so there's certainly that kernel of fear in me that, that something worse will happen once we forget about this. But
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Like we have to try to, we, you know, There's a series of paintings, and the name is escaping me, but essentially when all four are taken together, it's essentially like, you know, as a generations pass, we become less and less kind of aware of history and more comfortable, and then doomed to repeat the cycle over and over again.
But
do you think nuclear is still kind of a primary threat?
It's one of those things that, you know, a very small possibility of something very bad happening is still pretty bad, you know, like, but I don't know. I mean, I'm a person of faith too. So, I mean, I like to think that, you know, and I look at like God and good kind of synonymously. So I like to think that like good does prevail ultimately. And that, you know, one thing I learned in journalism school was like, you know, bad stuff makes the news, you know, because it's abnormal, you know, because, and we're wired to pay attention to that stuff, you know, like the, you know, like I always quote this, but like Mickey Rooney from, or no, Andy Rooney, sorry, I get my Rooney's mixed up. Andy Rooney from 60 Minutes wrote this column that I read as a kid that I always remembered. He said, like, so like, I'm just going to write about the good news for a column because everybody wants us to write about the good news. And he says, like, the oranges in Florida were hit by another day of average weather. They just hung there and grew, you know.
Yeah.
Like the crown prince put the jewels in the safe, and the next morning they opened up the safe and they were still there, you know, like it.
Yeah.
Normal stuff doesn't make news. And you have to kind of trust that there's a lot of normal stuff and a lot of normal people, like kind of keeping the world more or less chugging in a straight line, you know.
I think that's an extremely kind of helpful thing to think about, especially now where we're like sucked into Twitter and 24-hour news and everything's horrible.
Yeah.
You know, it's good to know that there's good. There is still good out there.
Yeah. And it's quieter than the bad, so it's easy to not pay attention.
Well, that's the thing too about reading someone like Richard Rhodes, where you get to know the personalities of the people behind, you know, the nuclear bomb and then the geopolitical stuff. Is that there's not really like destruction is not the intent. Maybe they're negligent and thinking about the future, but
But that's almost scarier when you realize that everybody's a good guy in their own head.
Like, and all it takes is an evil person to come around and use what they created for the wrong purpose. But cool. That makes me feel better. Actually, you know, I've just just been depressed by all sorts of news for. I never really thought of it that way.
So
it's really interesting to me too that you know you're writing quite a bit, heavily researched stuff, time consuming stuff, and you're also running this press, Tortoise Books, and. It's beloved. You know, I had Avner Landes on a while back and loved his book and loved that guy as well. And so what is it? When did this start? When did Tortoise start?
Well, it started with Resistance, actually, because I did the blind querying and nothing happened. And then when I did have a connect, like a friend of a friend who had worked at an agency, like I got it in front of one agent. And they were like, oh my gosh, this is great. Like we never get manuscripts that are in this good of shape. Like this is incredible. I was immediately going on to Wikipedia to find out like all the extra things behind this. And, you know, and they were just like everything you would want to hear from an agent. And I turned in a second, I turned in a revision to them and then they ghosted me, you know,
I
got it in front of another agent and they asked for the full manuscript and they ghosted me. And I was just like there's two kinds of authors, I think, or there's a spectrum. Like I think of a lot of different spectrums and like, there's people who like leave stuff on their desk and like polish and like never let it see the light of day. And then there's people who like get stuff out there too quickly. And they tend to be like the, you know, temperamentally like the person who tries to keep polishing it and stuff. And like Resistance, I had worked on it for 6 years by 2012, and I like I needed to get it off my desk so I could like move on to the next thing, you know. And I was getting married, I had a baby on the way, like all this stuff was happening. I didn't know what life was going to look like after all that. And I was like, I'd worked on a little indie literary newspaper. And I saw just how, kind of how fun and empowering it was to put stuff out there and to, you know, rather than getting rejection letters yourself, like give acceptances to somebody else, you know, is an amazing feeling. And I was like,
and probably choosing the stuff that you like too.
Yeah. Totally. And I was like, you know, I just had this vision of like that name, like tortoise, like the tortoise and the hare, like slow and steady wins the race. Like I've always loved that story. And I was like, there's gotta be other people who are in the same boat, you know? And, you know, so I put up a form on the website to start accepting submissions. And Gianno Cromley was the first outside author that we ended up picking up, and he had, you know, he had gotten an agent with his manuscript, and he had, you know, and but they were butting heads about it. So it wasn't coming out. And then the third author, like Darren Doyle, like he had gotten the New York deal, you know, he had a book out on St. Martin's, you know, and I think for whatever reason, if people, you know, if you have a book that doesn't sell as well as people think it's going to sell or like whatever, like it's a conservative business in the small C sense, in that people, you know, what works in the past, I think will work in the future. And, you know, if someone sold a lot in the past, they think they'll sell a lot in the future. And there's just no way of knowing until you get something out there. But, you know, the industry is just full of those stories of people who, you know, lost a chance or didn't get a chance or what have you, you know. So so it's good to at least, you know, give people a chance and, you know, just find stuff I'm excited about. It's just a fantastic feeling. And it's nice too, like as an author to like, you know, like my books feel like my kids, but like kids are pretty demanding, you know, and like,
yeah. What do you have, two kids now or?
Yeah. And,
so you got two demanding real kids and then you got all your kids.
Yeah. And other can people's be like, books. I can and be like the fun book. Uncle or whatever to like all these other people's books, you know, and take them out for a good time. And you know.
What are you publishing now? Like how frequently does Tortoise release a new book?
We're pretty much, so we're distributed by PGW now. So we're on there, you know, we're getting into sync with them. Basically they do a spring catalog, a winter catalog, and a fall catalog. So like we had three spring books. We just launched our third one this week. And then we have two fall books. We have Sin Vargas's On the Way, which is a really amazing story collection that was out there under another press that went defunct. And, you know, and I read it, and I was like, oh my gosh, these are amazing stories. Like, I can't believe I get a chance to, you know, because that's, I mean, you read a lot of stuff and some of it you're just kind of, you know, okay about, but then some of it you're like, oh my gosh, like I'm getting a chance to work with this.
That's been happening to me a lot with this podcast too, is like, it's interesting. And I'm sure you feel the same way, but when you're pursuing and you're reading, you know, what the hot shit of the moment is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't been grabbed by stuff. And when I started doing this podcast and like meeting people like yourself and Avner and whoever else, I'm like, and I read their work. I'm like, holy shit. Like, why isn't this? You know, why isn't this at front and center? Why isn't this being reviewed in the New Yorker or the, you know, the review of books or whatever? And it happens very frequently.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it's such a weird business. It's such a weird, you know, and it's so hard to tell, like, you know, is it expectation? Like, am I,
connections a lot of the time, it seems, too.
Like, did this, you know, the year Resistance came out, there was another book on the Heydrich assassination that came out that was it had been out previously in French, and so I don't know if the people at the agency that I was at just this, you know, just kind of looked this up and was like, oh, you know, there's mm-hmm. something, you know, but and it was a totally different take. It was very like postmodernist, like an author writing about himself, writing about the Heydrich assassination or whatever. And it was, it had its charms, but like, I got a review from a random stranger on Amazon that like liked my book better than that. And like, that was just fucking amazing to be
like, I bet.
You know, this book that was getting reviewed in Time and stuff, like.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool because it's you know, who knows? Again, we're talking about all the random factors of decisions and history and the variables and everything, but it's got to feel refreshing. At least I feel that you're running a meritocracy.
Trying. And I mean, that's...
you're only human, like, you know, you can't do it perfectly. Yeah.
The little 12-year-old boy in me, like, wanted to believe that America was a meritocracy, you know. Mm-hmm. As you grow up, you realize like all the ways in which that is not true. Like all the ways you get opportunities that somebody else doesn't get or whatever. And but you know, I still try to make it as meritocratic as I can. You know, I almost try to ignore the query letter, like, unless they put like zero effort into it
or
it's something that's clearly not in my wheelhouse, like fantasy. Like, I try not to think about like where they've been published before or what's on that. You know, I mean, I like it when people put it in there, but you know, but by the time I pick up the submission, I've probably forgotten it, you know, because you know, because I put it in a folder on my computer and then I assign it out to one of my readers or take it out myself, you know. And, you know, I try to just really see what's there on the page. And, mm-hmm. and sometimes there's a lot of like, the heartbreaking thing is there's a lot of like B+ stuff, you know, like there's a lot of like B+ stuff where you're like, all right, this is competent, you know, like you can put together sentences and create a scene, but I'm just not like, not looking forward to picking it up. And that's the stuff that you just have to, those are hard rejections, but that's the stuff you have to reject. But like every so often you get, you know, Avner was a total stranger, you know, and just, the little God voice was like, you know, check this one out, mm-hmm. you know, like just pick it up, mm-hmm. and like, you know, and you start laughing and you're like, oh my gosh. Like
yeah. That I was going to say, I think you have a deep appreciation for funny literature, or at least.
I'm not a laugh out loud person when I read it. I was just reading his book and laughing, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. Like, I can't wait to work with this guy. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So. He reminds me a lot of, I don't know how much Joseph Heller you've read.
I've read, you know, Catch 22.
Yeah. He's got this other book, Something Happened, that I'm reading right now. And Avner was, it's like equally that type of funny where it just resonates from such a deep place of the down and out, you know, but But yeah, I mean, it's just so cool to me that you're doing both. And like, I can't wait to follow Tortoise, and super happy to hear you finish the series. Like, that's got to feel great to be done with Altered Space and to move on to the next thing.
It's a nice feeling. It's a nice feeling because, you know, in part because I can do more time on the editing for the next stuff and, you know, get more books in the pipeline. And it's weird because there's this, I think if you're writing something you really enjoy, you enjoy that world of the book, you know, which to me, you know, like reading The Great Gatsby or something, like I like spending time in that world, you know, part of you doesn't want it to end, but you do want it to end because you want to finish it, you know.
And you want to move on to the next thing, which by the way, what is the next thing going to be?
Oh, for me writing?
Yeah.
I'm kind of obsessed with the Mormon Kingdom of Beaver Island.
I don't even know what that is. So
it's, well, Miles Harvey, this local Chicago author, he wrote a great nonfiction history about it that was kind of in the works for a while. And I kind of heard about it as I was talking about this. But like, yeah, basically this James Jesse Strang guy, was a Mormon, said he was Joseph Smith's heir or whatever, and like led these people up to Beaver Island and basically had his own little kingdom and, you know, like five wives and all this crazy stuff. And he ended up being like assassinated by one of his followers. But it's just a fascinating, weird, it's just one of those Wikipedia pages you stumble on.
Of course, yeah. Like, holy shit.
What? This like, this is real, like, you know.
Yeah, how has this not been mined for its narrative potential? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But but I also like, you know, I mean, I wanna, you know, there's that part of me that's like, well, I've gotta go to Beaver Island now. Like, I've gotta like,
yeah,
you know, live there for a week in the winter and live there for a week in the summer, you know,
just, yeah, I gotta go taste the dirt. Yeah.
Yeah, which like the space books I didn't have the means to do, so somewhat
maybe in 20 30 years, you know.
Yeah,
take a Virgin Galactic flight up there and do another altered space. But that's awesome. I'm absolutely buying Resistance if it's still available. I hope it's still around.
Oh yeah,
great. Yeah, I can't wait to read about that. In Tortoise Books. Okay. Yeah, I mean, you're doing so much. You're like,
thank you so much for all this time. Yeah, I feel like
you're like your own industry, and I'm really excited to follow it. So
cool.
Thanks so much for talking to me and for enlightening me. And
my pleasure. Truly.
Yeah, I'll talk to you very soon.
Cool. All right. All right. Take care.
All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed my talk with Gerald Brennan. Check out the description for links to his work. Check out Tortoise Books. Buy something. Do yourself a favor. Hope you learned as much from Gerald as I did. And we got Big Bruiser Dope Boy coming up next week. So very excited for that. Reach out. Be in touch. I'll talk to you soon.